This is Cave Scott Allen of otico.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded January 5, 2018. Happy New Year, everyone. Today we are talking to Matt Warren. Matt is a C-sharp coder, Microsoft MVP who loves measuring, finding, fixing performance issues. He's also a contributor to benchmark.net, among other things, and prolific blogger lately. You've been blogging quite a bit. I see you all the time on Hacker News, etc. So welcome.
Welcome. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So, I mean, top level, you know, you've been blogging about a lot of kind of performance and kind of deep dive into, you know, .NET source code. And I wonder, before we dig into any specific ones, just how do you go about, say, picking a topic and diving it? Like, how do you write these blog posts?
Yeah. So, I wish I had some sort of real clear plan I'd laid out. In a way, stumbled my way through. I think the very first one, it all happened after the .NET source was made available. So that's one thing. It became available, the core parts of the .NET runtime, I guess, have been open source for about 3 years now, just over. So when that happened, I started taking a look. And then I think the very first one where I dug into the real internals was looking at strings in the CLR. And I just noticed from some stuff in the source and some other places that, you know, strings were quite a sort of a special case. The runtime had to do a lot of things, and I dug into that. And then it kind of just went from there. I think I did strings, and then as I was doing that one, I found something else, and eventually I came back and did another one on arrays that was similar, looking at strings. So it just sort of grew organically. Each time I found out something that I didn't understand, I made a note of it, put a sort of drafts blog post, and then when I knew a bit more, came back to it. So there was no clear thing other than that I just felt it was a good opportunity to look at the stuff that's in the source, because we've always been able to use WinDBG or something like that. But now that the source is there, you get so much more. You can compile your own version of the CLR. You can run a debug version locally and get loads of information that way. You can there's some great internal documents called the Book of the Runtime that make some of this stuff available. So it's a lot easier now if you want to dig into this stuff. I'm not a expert C++ coder by any stretch of imagination, but I over time have found my way around the source code in there and just done it that way. So it sort of almost came about by accident. I've always liked looking at internals, and it just happened that as the time I wanted to do a bit more serious blogging, the source was available and this stuff was nice and easy. So I guess the long way of saying it, things came about by accident. I still have a list of about 10 other things that I've found along the way that I still want to write, and I imagine that as I write those 10 things, I'll probably find another 10 going that way. So it's not any clear plan, but I've certainly got enough. There's a lot of stuff in there to figure out. It'll keep me busy for quite a while longer.
Scott Kuhn, you'd mentioned some posts earlier that you found were interesting in your office. You want to jump in with that?
Oh, yeah. So we primarily do lots and lots of manipulation of arrays. So the arrays in the CLR post was fascinating to me. But we also find that we end up with really wide arrays. So like, you know, we'll have 1,800 elements in a single array, and then we'll have 24,000 of those single arrays in another array, kind of representing data that's coming in. And so the memory usage inside of the CLR part was fascinating to us too, because we end up a lot of time trying to skirt around the large object fragmentation issue. So we're like, okay, we got to keep these allocations down, and we got to keep them within the scope so that they immediately get GC'd or get, you know, shoved away so that we can, you know, I think in one of our catch blocks, we even have that, go ahead and compress the LOH, and then we call GC after it. And we have, you know, a note in there like, we really shouldn't do this, but hey, we're going to do this. So those two posts resonated with me.
That's good. It's always nice to know that something's not just interesting to learn about, but there's some, you know, for me, it's interesting to figure this stuff out, but it's nice to know that sometimes it helps people out. Yeah, the array was an interesting one. So I sort of said about it before. I'd come across the fact that strings aren't just a kind of regular type that you could make yourself. They're a fairly special class, and they have some special properties. And similar with arrays, they're very much provided in a specialist way by the runtime. The runtime makes them possible. And it kind of makes a bit of sense, really, that they have to be special because everything is then built on top of them, you know, lists and dictionaries and all the other sort of stuff all end up working on top of arrays. So, yeah, as if people haven't read the post, it goes through a lot of the things that the runtime does to make arrays possible. The arrays are mandated by the specs. There's certain stuff that a runtime has to provide to conform with the CLR spec, or the ECMA spec, I guess, is the correct name, and to make, you know, just even newing arrays and things like that. When you new up arrays, it's a different arrays, unlike almost any other class that we create ourselves, aren't fixed size. The whole point of arrays is they can be variable size, like you say, thousands of elements in size, and they can have multi-dimensional arrays coming off them. So there's a lot of special cases and things like that that the runtime makes possible, and also the performance. The JIT and other places do a lot of work to make sure that you can access arrays as quickly as possible. You wouldn't want any overhead in arrays because there are so many other things are built on top of them. So, yeah, it's a nice sort of eye-opener to me to kind of understand some of the internals and realize that the runtime can do some pretty hairy tricks to make all this sort of stuff possible. And yeah, it seems like it's a common thing across most runtimes. Strings and arrays are kind of special cases. And, yeah, they let you build on stuff. And the runtime, yeah, basically has a kind of bunch of special cases to make arrays possible, which is quite nice. And
especially the stuff around types. That comment from Mark Gravel, that arrays are basically voodoo because they predate generics, but it must allow on-the-fly type creation. I was like, when I read that, I was like, oh yeah, you're right.
Yeah. This must be, this and his comment, and also I talked about it before, but if anyone wants to get into the internals of .NET, there's something called the Book of the Runtime. It's on, so it's github.com/.NET/core-CLR-repository. There's a documentation section, and it's called the Book of the Runtime. Scott Hansman also did a post writing up about it, and loads of this stuff is in there. I'd say about a third or a half of my posts have been reading the Book of the Runtime, not understanding it, and then trying to figure it out, because they're written for people who are working on the runtime. They're written by Microsoft, well, have always been by Microsoft employees for other people working on the runtime. So they're not, you know, they're not necessarily a easy way into it. There's kind of an expectation of a fair amount of runtime knowledge, but they are the kind of definitive guide of all this sort of stuff. And I read something similar to what Mark was saying in there, and and basically the runtime magically swaps in and breaks a whole load of type safety that it would enforce anywhere else to make all the generic stuff appear on arrays. And it's in the post, but it's got the best method name I think I've found so far in the source, which is, this is one single method, is get actual implementation for array generic iList or iRead only list method. It's a single method that does all this crazy wiring up, but it's in effect works. Yeah, I suppose type unsafety is fine when it's the runtime, but it does some funky stuff to make generics appear on arrays, like, as you said, they were been around before generics were there. So it's interesting when you kind of figure this, you see this stuff, you know, you've always used, like yourself, you know, I've used arrays a lot and kind of almost taken them for granted, just assumed it's a chunk of memory, but it's the stuff the runtime has to make possible for us to be able to use, you know, enumerate over an array and treat a list as an array and all those sorts of things. There's a whole lot happening there that we, I guess, take for granted most of the time.
I've always felt it's kind of weird, the kind of side-by-side thing of, like, there's the arrays, which have like a nice, I mean, it's a simple syntax for declaring, initializing, all that with an array. But then usually the right way or the better way to do things is to start using things like generic lists or, you know, but for those, they're kind of, the syntax isn't as simple and you end up kind of jumping back and forth. I mean, is that something, like, as you're digging into the implementation and all the kind of voodoo that goes on there, is that kind of, from that point of view, is that always going to be like that, or is it something where you can layer some syntactic sugar on more, or do you know what I mean?
So it's true. I mean, you kind of want to, wherever possible, use the higher level stuff, because, you know, I've written posts about, say, link and stuff, and there's, you know, sometimes for performance reasons you don't want to go high level, but certainly it's much nicer to write stuff in link than deal with, you know, array indexes and for loops and stuff like that. It's much easier when you get to the level of for each. And actually, I guess it's a combination of, well, it's the jitter mostly helps us out a lot. So you can, in a lot of cases, use slightly higher level stuff like a for each over an array versus having to drop down to a you know, 4i=0. You don't need to go to that level, and the jitter does some job to make that possible. That's one of the things I touched on a bit in that post. It's sort of the main bit it does in arrays is it, because it knows about them, and it can get rid of some of the bounds checking that is the performance cost. So it's quite nice. You in a lot of cases you can have the nice slightly higher level syntax but have the performance. It doesn't always work out, and there's loads of different edge cases around it, but generally there's a lot of stuff being done by the jitter, and I suppose the language as well, to, you know, we don't have to write code that looks like C or C++, which is quite nice.
Well, you're talking about that, like, how does this tie in with some of the new kind of intrinsics that allow direct, you know, access over memory and low allocation and all that?
Oh, you're talking about the span of T.
Exactly. Yep.
So, well, interesting enough, it's another thing they did there. So, it'd be too hard to explain that, but there's lots of stuff out there talking about span. So people have probably heard of span, and the idea is that it gives you a nice, easy way to deal with chunks of memory, and you just deal with a span, and you don't really care whether that span is on top of a raw memory or an array or whatever it is. It's kind of hidden from you. And again, the jitters had to do a whole load of stuff there to make. So I really like the span thing, because I guess for a lot of people, it may be only sort of they got to know about it around build last year, or there's been some articles on MSDN blogs and other places talking about it more recently. So it's becoming more known. But if anyone had been following any of the .NET GitHub repositories, span has been worked on for quite a long time, because it's probably a fairly unique example in terms of all the bits involved. So we're now seeing span being used at a high level in lots of APIs. You'll be able to use more and more APIs in the .NET based class libraries that take a span and work with spans and give you, you know, substrings and all that sort of stuff can take spans. And that's great. And that's the kind of the last bit, but there's loads of stuff gone underneath. So just as a real quick thing, because I think it's a nice example, I guess about two and a half years ago, they started work in the CoreFX Labs repository, which is under the .NET organization. There's one called CoreFX Labs that I don't know how many people know about it, but it's a sort of a place for them to try out stuff. Stuff in there is very much being worked on. You wouldn't want to rely on anything in there. It's changing. You know, there's a lot of churn, but they were working on the APIs and working out what would span look like, what methods it needs to have, how's it going to work. And so it kind of then graduated from there, and it made its way into the runtime. And there's quite a lot of runtime work done because of span. Under the hood is the GC, the runtime. Lots of places need to know about it. It's quite a special type, or it's a class of a special type, where you can't allocate it on the heap. It has to stay on the stack, because that's what gives it the main performance. So there's stuff around that. The runtime has to treat it differently. It has to make sure you can't do any incorrect things with it. And then the compiler, ultimately most people use the Roslyn or another compiler and write their code that way. And the compiler also has to do all those checks. So it's really interesting to see it basically work its way through all these things. And it's now got to the point in I guess, .NET Core 2, where it's out there, and we're going to see it used more and more in the different libraries. And I guess over time, once it's baked into the runtime more, then people will use it more in their own libraries, and I think it'll be quite a widely used thing. It's not applicable for every scenario, but there's a lot of scenarios where it's useful, and it's nice as well to see something that's mostly around high performance. I mean, there's a nice ease of use around it and stuff like that, but it's a lot of the benefit is for high performance, and they're prepared to put this new fairly fundamental type into the runtime that gives you performance benefits. So it's been quite a good thing to yay for open source, I guess, to be able to follow it through that way and see the stuff. One of the bits I've seen recently is the performance side of it. They want to make sure that you can use span and you can get the same performance when you're using span against an array than if you're accessing the array or as close as possible. There's always a slight overhead because it's doing something slightly different, but they want to make sure that where they can, the jitter and other places in the runtime can make the performance good. So yeah, it's probably another blog post, actually. The history of span.
We just assumed that it was driven by most of the ASP.NET team trying to parse headers.
Yeah, I think that is quite a nice use case for it. Yeah, that and substrings. I think that's probably the first thing people will start to use it for is anything around text parsing, where before you've had to do really clunky stuff with, is it array segments, and you have to pass around the array and the array segment, and you know, an offset and all that sort of stuff, and it span takes all that away. You in effect pass around a span, and it's also quite a nice boon for .NET Core as well, because .NET Core has what's known as the fast span, which the runtime is optimized and other sort of stuff. You can use it in the, I don't know if the original or traditional .NET desktop framework, you can use span, but it's a different implementation. It's implemented purely as a library, so it's you know, there's, again, there's an extra benefit, as well as the fact that we're probably going to get it in APIs in .NET Core away before those same APIs appear in .NET Framework. So it's again, it's a sort of a benefit of people using .NET Core and stuff. The being out, I don't know if breaking, not necessarily breaking backwards compatibility, but the ability to move quicker, and you know, all the benefits that come from this new way of doing out in the open as well, but doing .NET in a different kind of way than has been done with the .NET that's tied to the Windows operating system, all those sort of stuff. There's a lot of benefits for that. So yeah, we're certainly getting the span stuff a bit earlier, and getting the fast span as well, which is nice.
So that brings up you wrote a post, memory usage inside the CLR, and you talked about things like VM map, which I hadn't been aware of. Is that, what are some of the main things you'd use to kind of look into understanding memory use and optimizing and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so I mean, there's I guess to two levels. That particular post is looking at where the runtime itself allocates memory. So a large part of the memory that the runtime allocates is the heap for the garbage the garbage collector provides, and ultimately are, you know, when we allocate an array or anything in .NET code, that goes on the garbage collector heap. So that's quite a large part of it, and it builds up the heap and all that side of things. But there's also a whole load of memory usage for the .NET runtime, the CLR runtime itself, and that post was particularly digging into that. That's why I used VM map, which is, if people haven't heard of it, it's one of the sysinternals tools, and it's great. I mean, their tools are fantastic for any sort of low level stuff. They give you loads of information, but this one particularly will show you quite detailed overview of the memory uses of a process, and it also is quite tied in. Well, it certainly seems to have a bit of a knowledge of the .NET runtime as well, so it can pick out .NET managed heaps and things like that. So in terms of low level stuff, that's probably a bit overkill if you're just looking at your usage of your .NET application. You know, the .NET runtime, that was that allocates when it feels like. You don't have much control if it needs to allocate memory, because it needs to allocate memory for the code. When a jitter jits code, takes our code from IL into JIT code, it needs somewhere to put that code. So that's one place. It has its own internal heaps for its own data structures and all those sorts of things. You can't do too much about that. But generally, the one is looking at the .NET garbage collector. That's the way most people are digging into memory usage when you're looking at your own code in the .NET runtime. And there's lots of profilers and commercial ones. I use a tool. I keep talking about a tool called Purview, which is, if people haven't heard of it, it's often, if they've seen it, they'll recognize it. It's not the most pretty tool, I put it that way, but it's a very powerful tool and can give you quite a lot of information. And as far as I know, actually, internal teams in Microsoft use Purview for diagnosing stuff. It does more than just memory usage. But yeah, in terms of if I was digging into my own .NET code and looking at that, I'd pick any one of the, I don't want to name names of different companies, but anyway, there's quite lots of well-known memory profilers that do a really great job of helping you find out memory leaks and stuff. But my idea with that low-level one is to actually show that, you know, that there's outside of .NET is a managed runtime, and we kind of look at the managed bit and we see our side of it, but there's a lot of stuff going on under the hood, and one bit is what it's doing to allocate memory and how it's controlling that and things like that, and there's quite a bit going on under the hood.
The memory profiler to use to find leaks that we use most often is called production.
Oh, yes, it's true, yeah.
When we get an email
saying,
hey, how come there's this funny exception here? What is... how can it be out of memory? We've got 16 gigs in the thing. It's like, oh, hang on.
Yeah. There's always that thing. You can try as much as you want and have, you know, great performance testing or load testing or whatever, but there's always those things that only pop up in production. I think as well, quite a lot of the tools now are able to, you wouldn't necessarily want to run them in production all the time, but if something is going wrong, I think most tools are okay, you know, for a little while to at least give, you know, things are going horrendously wrong, you can attach to, some of them allow you to attach to an existing process and stuff like that. So there's a, yeah, there's a nice range of commercial tools out there that, that do that. It's pretty handy when production's going wrong.
So you had another post look at the internals of boxing in the CLR. And as part of that, one thing that jumped out at me was there's a section in there called the CPU specific code generation, where you look at differences in, say, AMD 64 and x86. Is that something where there's, is, does that come up regularly where there's different, you know, CPU specific instructions? I mean, and part of this, I've been keeping an eye on some of the SSE and SIMD work that's been going on, and I'm kind of excited about, but I don't know how much it's actually going to matter, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. So, it turns out there is a fair amount. So in the part of the source in CoreCLR that's known as the VM, the virtual machine, there's a fair few places. I think I've read something that in an ideal world, they'd like to be able to write almost everything in C# or C++, but for performance reasons, and because, you know, if you want to write it in C#, you need the jitter to be able to do it. So there's certain stuff that you just can't do that way. So they have to drop down at certain points into raw assembly, and particularly when you get to stuff around boxing or method calls or stuff that's specific to the GC or stuff that's, you know, several assembly code instructions. You want to make sure you're doing the most efficient thing for each CPU, and at that level, you know, different CPU architectures have different instruction sets, or they have different, you know, 64-bit, 32-bit. So yeah, there's a whole section where the runtime will in effect swap in the right version of the assembly code, and you can go through the says i386, AMD 64, AMD and ARM, and actually it comes into a bit with the, it's quite interesting. So Samsung have been doing a bit of stuff with Tizen, raking the CLR work on their Tizen OS, and they've actually contributed in certain areas a whole lot of code, particularly in the CLR. And one of the things they've helped do is port it to the, I guess it's the AMD 64, is it? No. Anyway, I forget off the top of my head. But anyway, one of the particular CPU ones ties up with what they're doing. And it's quite interesting to see the open source side of things. And actually, I think two or three of the Samsung engineers are some of the high, you know, maybe in the top 10 of contributors for the CoreCLR repo. So they're putting a lot of work in and doing a lot of low level stuff. So when you get down to the level of, say, boxing or the garbage collector, or I've been recently looking again for a future post on like method calls and that sort of stuff, you're talking about CPU instructions, registers, all that sort of stuff. And it does vary per architecture. So I think they try to not do it if at all possible, because there's a cost, you know, you have to then maintain it across four, you know, architectures. You don't get it for free when you want a new architecture. You have to go and port that section of code and things like that. So I think they try to stay away from it unless there's a real good reason around performance, or you just can't express it in C or C++, yeah. I guess would be the other reason. But yeah, there's a whole chunk of stuff hidden under there. And it's the bit I can just about read enough assembly code if it's commented to understand it. I certainly couldn't write it, but I don't tend to necessarily know what the ins and outs of the assembly code does, but I kind of understand the mechanism of how it swaps it all in and uses it. And it's quite interesting that, and boxing, particularly, there's a concept of why it was in that post. There's a concept in the CLR of stubs, which is a small bit of assembly code, maybe three or four instructions that are used in different places. One is for boxing and other places as well. And they often are written in hand-coded assembly for the particular runtime to be as efficient as possible, because when you box an object, sometimes the method calls go via these stubs. Are like you call a stub does a few little things and then jumps you to the actual method you want to call. It does kind of intercepts it and does a bit of work in between, and obviously if you're doing that a lot, you want that work to be as efficient as possible. So that's why those stubs tend to be written in assembly code.
Yeah, the Samsung that you were calling out, Samsung work, pretty sure that's on ARM. They've contributed quite a bit there.
Oh, thank you.
So, the one, and this is like over my head, and I'm constantly checking Wikipedia and hoping that it's right, but like the SIMD and SSE support that's being added for some of the stuff that's like and I forget the thing, but it's basically like index of, you know, but at the exactly.
Oh, the vector stuff. So, do you mean the vector in the API? Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 That'll be, yeah. I don't know if the runtime itself will make use of that, but yeah, it'd be nice that the, yeah, as you say, there's this new vector API and it, yeah, again, that'd be something just looking because basically it's coded in regular code, but when the runtime supports by using those, when it sees you're using those vector classes, it knows, it understands those classes and can swap out for the SIMD instructions or whatever the equivalent on a different architecture. So it's, yeah, it's nice. It's kind of, I think, as far as I know, it's one of the first times we've had that sort of thing in .NET. You know, I think the runtime or the JIT has been able to make use of that stuff behind the scenes for us, but for us to be able to explicitly say, you know, I understand that there's these instructions available and I want to use the vector class and I want them to have all the optimizations and things like that, is quite nice that we're getting that sort of stuff in .NET, definitely, yeah.
So speaking of jitter, one of your recent posts here was a look at the internals of the tiered JIT compilation in .NET Core. And that's... Your diagrams, by the way, are very helpful here. But like the whole idea about this kind of like there's pre-code fix up and there's stubs and all that. Like what does this actually mean to me as far as, you know, how my code runs?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess there's a few things. So I liked writing about this because it's basically it's not been it's still being worked on. Like I only saw this because I was following the core CLR repository, and there's a few sort of design documents. So again, it's I sort of sound like a bit too much of a fanboy, I guess, but it is nice that when Microsoft are doing this stuff, that they actually are doing it. It's not that we're just suddenly getting this code appear from nowhere. There's obviously been times where stuff's appeared and people haven't been happy, but I'll stay away from that. But generally for most stuff, it's this stuff's appearing. There's also design documents talking about it. There's issues, you know, there's people aside from myself who started raising bugs and talking about this tiered JIT compilation. So up until this came out or is coming out, sorry, it's not even really officially in .NET Core yet. I don't know when that's going to be released as the default option. But up until this point, when you call it, when you run your .NET code in most scenarios, the jitter takes the IL code that the compiler makes for us and turns it into whatever the relevant machine code for the CPU you're running on. And that happens once. And it does this, again, it uses this idea of these stubs. It puts in a kind of interception stub. And the first time you call a method, it jumps over to the jitter does its work. At the end of that, it actually rewrites the stub so that next time you call the method, it goes to the location of the code it's compiled instead of the stub in between, and that's what the first half of that post is talking about, is that where it goes through stages of fix ups and pre stubs, and they're just the internal names. I just stuck with them because it made most sense. But it's the idea that every time you first call a method in .NET, it gets jitted, and it gets jitted just the once, and then it stays like that and it runs like that. If you're from, or if people are aware of the Java side of things, they have something called Hotspot, which has been around in the JVM for a long time, and that works very differently. It in effect, the first few times it interprets the code, doesn't even compile it down to machine code, it just runs it as Java bytecode. Then when it decides the method's been called enough or it's a hotspot, that's I guess where the name comes from, that it then does compiles it the first time, and then it may even actually compile it again if it decides that it could do a better job the second time. So it does a quick compile the first time, that's just get some code out there that's, you know, assembly code that can be run but might not be the most efficient, because there's a, obviously, when the JIT JIT takes time. So that's why you sometimes have startup issues in .NET and NGen, and other things that kind of come around to get rid of that. Because the first time you call a method, it has to JIT that method. And then if that method calls another method, it JITs that, and you kind of get this big chain of stuff. So there is a cost to JITting. So what they're looking at doing with the tiered compilation is having a way that you have tiers of compilation, I guess the name gives it away, that you start with a quicker compilation that might not be the most efficient or might be the most performant machine code, but is at least machine code. But it also puts in a counter, and when that method's then being called, currently it's 30 times, I imagine I'll do something more intelligent in the future about how many times, when that method's been called several times, it might then say, okay, it's now worth spending a bit longer. The method, we can do it in the background asynchronously because the method is always already running, so we can take a bit longer. We can do the most optimizations that JIT can do because we're not constrained by any time. We're not blocking the method being called. When it's done the more optimized version, it can be swapped out and hopefully in the diagrams in the second half of that post if people, it's very hard to explain, but the idea is it has a stub in the way and it can in effect redirect it, and it could be done multiple times. It's not just once or twice. It could be and it's part of a larger bit of work to say, actually, is there a way to have multiple different optimizations for a single method based on whatever criteria? A tool could come in and say, I'd like to optimize this method and I want to give you the code and just swap it in and stuff like that. So I think it's part of something else, but it's quite an interesting change because it's a fairly fundamental change. .NET has never had this idea of jitting a method for a second time, and whilst it's not necessarily going to be saying visible, it's certainly all going on behind the scenes. I think the idea is that there should be a performance. I don't think they would do it otherwise. There should be a performance boost because a lot of methods don't get called lots of times. So you can do a quicker JIT across them. You can spend less time because you know that they're going to only be called multiple times. So there's no point doing lots of optimizations. But some methods are called a lot. They're part of a hot path. They're on every page of your application, or they're on 60 times a second in a game, or whatever it might be. They're part of that hot path. So you want to spend, when you know what those methods are, you want to spend more time up doing more optimizations so that they run over time. Well, they run over time quicker. So yeah, that's hopefully a quick view, but it's nice because it's a very new feature, and they're just literally at the moment they're just putting in place the mechanism to make it possible to switch out a bit of code a second time, and then I believe over time there'll be then work done to make the jitter work in the two different modes. I think they call it minimum optimization, min-opt mode, and then I guess maximum optimization or things like that. So, yeah, again, it's a really nice one for watching as things are going on or watching things are happening.
So I've read about profile-guided optimization as well. Is that something that fits in here?
I think that's more with I guess it's a similar class of it. That's, as far as I know, the .NET runtime itself makes use of that when it compiles its own code. It can use, as far as I understand at the moment, that's currently only used for the C and C++ code in the runtime. It compiles that based on previous knowledge of what's the most efficient way to lay it out. But yeah, I guess this is a similar scenario in terms of, why optimize a method heavily if it gets called once a minute, once a second, if the performance isn't needed. But if a method gets called 1,000 times a second, yeah, go for it. Do a lot of optimization. So it's a similar idea. Yeah.
Okay. And then you mentioned the Java hotspot, and you do call that out in your post. You say, why not interpreted there? Is that so? What's the kind of reasoning behind not using kind of a hotspot approach?
Yeah, so I actually asked, again, it's quite nice because it's all on GitHub. You can, when they first, one of the first issues talking about it came up, I asked exactly the same question because Java runs an interpreted mode and then JIT compiles a minimum version and maximum. The last answer I got was that the there is an interpreter built into the .NET runtime, but it's not meant for production and it's not got all the support for, like, you can't debug interpreted code currently in .NET runtime. The interpreter is meant for when they port the .NET runtime to a new architecture. Until you have the jitter fully working, you can't run any code because the interpreter allows them to at least get something up and running and then bit by bit actually run code, as the jitter knows about it. So you can say, only jit this one method and leave everything else to be interpreted. Because I think it would be nice, certainly it seems to work out for Hotspot to run it interpreted a few times. I did wonder actually, because Mono recently made a .NET interpreter and released it as an option for their runtime. So it'd be interesting to see if stuff ever goes that way. In terms of, I think as far as I know, there's some stuff making its way from the core CLR, the one that's on the Microsoft repository up on GitHub. Some of that stuff is potentially making its way into Mono, things like the garbage collector and other stuff. I've seen discussions about it might happen. It'd be interesting to see if something that Mono's developed comes into it. So, you know, potentially that's an option. If there's a more production-ready interpreter available in Mono, that it may be something that could be used as an option. But the main developer who's currently working on a tiered compilation from Microsoft was saying that it's not in their plans at the moment to do an interpreted version.
Okay. So another recent post you had was about a denial of service attack against a C# compiler. And in that case, you had like like deeply nested generics. Is that a good way to describe it?
That is, yeah. That was a bit of. I was at a conference, and one of the other speakers there mentioned, was with the guy, I'm sure you know, Ben Adams, was speaking there, and me and him were chatting, and another speaker came up to us. I'm going to butcher his name, but I'm going to go that it's Jiri Kinsuara, but I apologize for him getting his name wrong. But anyway, he let me know about this bit of code, and he said, if you put this into the compiler, it basically blows up, and he's right, it does. So it's to do with nested generics, and what I basically showed in the post is it grows exponentially. Every layer you increase, so it's a class with multiple generic parameters, and inside that you kind of go down the levels. So you have a class, for instance, called inner, and you have a property which is not just inner, it's inner dot inner dot inner dot inner, and it's in effect not quite recursive, but each layer, the way when the .NET does the runtime, when it builds up these types, it has to build them up in a special way. So even though it looks like you're just increasing it by one level each time, it's actually growing exponentially under the scenes, and it blows up quite quickly. I think I got to 11 levels on my computer before it just was out of memory, and it was already taking 3 or 4 minutes just to compile it. That was a sort of a fun post. And I don't tend to do too much around the language side of stuff. I haven't yet got into the Roslyn because obviously there's all that's open source as well. I've stuck to the runtime, but that was a nice diversion to try stuff out. And other people posted the Mono compiler does a bit better in this case, actually, interestingly enough. It can go a few levels deeper before it goes wrong. But I think by the 10th level, it was producing a 1 gig binary.
Wow.
It was using 2 gig of memory to compile it, and it was taking 3 minutes to compile. So, that's a fun thing. And it turns out that it's pretty, one of the guys who's on the compiler team on Twitter commented, I think it's basically because of the language spec, it has to, you should never write code like this. That's one thing I make clear in the post. But the compiler actually has to compile this type of code. It's kind of mandated in the spec that it does what it's doing. So it's not necessarily something they can get rid of. In effect, they have to. Any attempt to make it more efficient is just going to, it's exponential. So it's going to blow up whatever you do. It'll just take a bit longer to blow up. But I think Ben Adams had a go at trying to optimize some of it, and he got a bit of a way, but you ran up against the fact that basically it's just doing, it's a type system thing. And I linked to an explanation in the post on someone on Stack Overflow explained it, and I read the explanation from the type system of what's going on. I think I read it 3 times and still didn't quite get it. I can see what it's doing, but in terms of what the type system's doing there to make all these subclasses work
It's interesting
stuff.
In the comments, people call out the billions of laughs in XML. There's in XML parser, and there's zip bombs, which you can have like a zip file that, blows a tiny zip file that blows up super huge. I think I've seen denial of service kind of things in regular expressions too, like, sites or things that allow you to input a regex.
Yes.
And the regex can do insane thing. And like you said, it's mandated by the language specifications. It's just, that's part of what some of these, because they are recursive in nature, right?
Yeah. I was just about to paste it into one of the online C# compiler sites before I thought better of it. And I didn't want to, because I did a post a bit before and I encouraged people to use one of those sites, and it ended up the site was having to recycle because it was so. I guess that's the only time it becomes a, I mean, title's slightly tongue in cheek. It's only really an issue if people have a site that lets you upload arbitrary C# code and it tries to compile it, they might have some problems. But the two that I checked that I know about have a built-in timeout, or they run out of memory. So DOS attack might be quite strong, but it's certainly interesting. There's not many times you can make the compiler go crazy like that. And certainly if you run it in, I had to run it from the command line, like .NET build and stuff. If you run it in Visual Studio, it goes wrong a bit quicker. I guess Visual Studio's doing things a bit differently. So you can paste that code into Visual Studio and watch it come to its knees.
Wow.
So .NET Core obviously is cross-platform. And as you're rooting around in there, I'm curious, like, how much of that does that tendril into the code? Like, you know, how much of the cross-platforminess sort of leaks around in the class libraries or in the code base, or is it like really nicely encapsulated?
Certainly from the point of the core CLR, the runtime side of things, it's quite nicely abstracted. I mean, there's the CPU specific stuff we talked about before, where it has custom assembly code and stuff like that. But there's a thing called the platform adaption layer, the PAL, and as far as I know, that handles most of it. So in theory, that you can on any OS, you can call the PAL equivalent of a function, and then it behind the scenes deals it. So I think they've tried to put it all in one place. It is. From what I remember, I did look at one time quite soon after it came out. I think it's someone from the community, in effect, did a lot of the work to port .NET to, was it FreeBSD or something like that? And it was, you know, it was a large amount of work, but it was reasonably self-contained. So I think that in the runtime itself, it's C and C++, so it's reasonably cross-platform. They've sort of put it in one place. But on the other side of stuff, if you look at a high level, like the core effects, the base class libraries, I've certainly seen cases where people have complained that their code works in one and the other, and that's the kind of classic stuff around file paths and things like that. So it's there's two ends of it. This is certainly a good test, isn't it, of how cross-platform the CLR really is, that it's getting used in certain things. But yeah, and if you're talking just about the runtime side of things, which I know the most, I know it does seem fairly, they can just change it in one place. They can, in effect, implement a new platform, which is quite nice. I've already seen, what was the one I was looking at recently? Someone done some work to make all the profiling APIs that are available in .NET, which then make the tooling available. They're starting to do some of the work to make that available on different platforms, because it's interesting. There's sort of different levels. There's one thing of like running your code on different platforms, but then as you get down to the lower level stuff, like there's still, I think, a bit of people waiting for the CLR profiling APIs to be completely available cross-platform. So yeah, sorry, it's kind of a long way around of saying it. It does vary in different places. The core parts of things like anything in C# should generally be that part of it. There is actually bits of the core CLR written in C#, and those bits have obviously worked reasonably well across platform. But what I've seen a fair bit of it definitely is actually they've been removing. It's interesting to see they've actually done a lot of work of removing stuff out of the core CLR. As far as I know, it started from the Silverlight code base, because that was the one that was the most cross-platform, which I guess makes a bit of sense. And over time, they've pulled bits out, you know, app domains and anything Windows-specific. It's quite interesting to see that, obviously, .NET traditionally only ran on Windows. So there's quite a lot of Windows assumptions baked in, or stuff that's only Windows-specific. So actually, you're seeing over time, in certain areas, more and more stuff being pulled out of the CLR that's not needed in this new cross-platform core CLR world. There's a lot of stuff that's not needed. So kind of works both ways, actually. It's, maybe by the end of it, it'll all even out and there'll be about the same amount of code. I don't know.
So an interesting post you did recently was on analyzing C# code on GitHub with BigQuery. And this is just C# code in general, not runtime. This is everybody's C# code, right? And some interesting things you dug into here, like tabs versus spaces and regions and, you know, where should I put my braces and stuff like that. So one thing that jumped out, the leading question of all time, tabs versus spaces. And it was interesting to see 82% was spaces versus tabs.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. So it's, I don't know if anyone else has played around, but the BigQuery is pretty amazing. You can basically write something that looks very, or is pretty much SQL. There's a few extensions, but it's basically SQL, but with all the aggregation group by and sum and count and all that sort of stuff. And then it goes away and runs it across. I think the one I was looking at was, I put it in there, sort of 500,000. It's basically they put the entire, what GitHub made available of all the open source projects that GitHub made available to them. They uploaded that. And then someone had done a subset, which was just the C# or .cs files, I guess. So that was, I think it was down to about 5 million files, hundreds of millions of lines of code. It's quite a reasonable chunk. And you run these queries in like 20 seconds or less. It's pretty impressive. If you want to see some, if you want to get an understanding of how it works, there's some amazing videos. The amount of engineering and stuff that went into this, it's obviously the optimization of code to make it run these queries fast, but they have crazy networks where they can farm these queries out to hundreds of nodes and then pull it back together. And there's a lot of good videos online. But yeah, so I stumbled across this BigQuery stuff, and someone had made the data set. The main thing you got to remember with using BigQuery is they have a free tier of, I think you can use something around 0.5 gig of queries. You get charged for the data that you query against. So it's quite handy that someone made a subset, because if you just query against just a C# code, it counts as a lot less in terms of the queries. So that was quite handy. So on their free tier they give you every month, I was able to write all these queries, and it's fun. So yeah, the tabs versus spaces, I mean, it is only the open source C# code on GitHub. So whether that's completely representative, I'm sure there's a fair amount of C# code out there that isn't on GitHub, but it's still quite a large sample size. So it's just nice. I tried to look at different ones. Some of the ones around tabs spaces was quite good, about how much regions are used. There's quite a large amount of C# files that have the region, you know, the hash region statement in there, which most people are not happy about. It seems that about two-thirds of C# developers prefer putting the opening brace on a separate line, but a third of us don't mind doing it on the same line, although there is some mitigating stuff with lambdas and stuff that makes it a bit different, but generally, yeah. So whereas I guess in other languages, I do a bit of Java in my day job, and they very much prefer the opening brace on the same line. So yeah, it's a bit of fun, but it started off some nice language flame wars and various other bits like that. The other ones were quite fun, was looking through the CS proj and other bits to see how many, which using statements are the most popular and things like that. Although, as someone pointed out, a lot of them are in the default template, so it's not.
Right.
System collections generic comes very high up, but that's not necessarily a true view. But the one bit I did, was pretty happy to put my name behind, is that JSON.NET is very widely used, if not the most widely used. It's the one that showed up the most in packages.config. So that's something, although again, some of those are out of the box and stuff. But yes, it's not many times you get to run queries in 20 seconds that chew through 30 gig of source code, and it doesn't cost you a penny. That's
I felt like the most interesting part of here, actually, not, you know, I mean, there's the kind of like syntax related things, but like digging a little deeper,
yeah.
The C#, do C# developers like writing functional code? And that was interesting looking at, you know, use of the Lambda operator and Lambdas in general, like, so it looked, you know, what's kind of the idea there? How functional do you see?
Yeah. No, that was fun. It gets a bit tricky because I was relying on regex, because that's basically what you get in the big query. So hopefully most of my query, I tried to make them as accurate as possible, but a few people pointed out I had to rerun a few and update the post.
Yeah.
A few of my regex is a bit lacking, because ideally you'd want to actually properly parse it and do a real syntax analysis, because there's a bunch, you know, it's hard to detect sometimes if stuff's in comments or whatever. So you're a bit limited, but I think across that many files, you're probably going to get still a reasonable amount. But yeah, I like the one with the var keyword. It seems to be, you know, the uses of how many people. I think I updated it in the end that more people use var than they use async await. Well, there's more files that are using var than async await. That was one of the ones that I found interesting. The other ones were like number of lines of code as well. We're a number of lines of code in a method. I was trying to dig into those. Yeah, it's just I think that one I came to the conclusion that Uncle Bob wouldn't be too happy because too many C# files have too many lines of code, or too many C# methods have too many lines of code. Doesn't fit with his clean code guidelines. But the thing is, when you think about it a bit more, there's always mitigation. There's code that's produced by tools, or there's other stuff as well. So I guess a good probably extension would be to do the similar test for Java, say, and see, you know, is there any things there? But yeah, it's quite fun to analyze stuff from that point of view. I think most popular class names, bizarrely, it seemed that class C was the most popular. Beat class program as well. So
wow.
And assemblyinfo.cs was the most widely used file name, which is probably not that surprising.
Yeah.
Followed by program.cs, but the MVC ones came at homecontroller.cs and was quite high up in the list as well. So yeah, but part of it, I guess, is biased by what stuff is on GitHub. So
yeah. Well, and like you said, by the file new project conventions, and also with MVC, the convention of home controller being the default controller, all that. Yeah.
What? Yeah. One serious thing I did try to see, I wanted to see if any of the C# compiler team would consider, I was wondering if they were ever interested in doing some sort of test like this to see, you know, how much are the features getting used. And they said they had thought about it. They'd run into the thing I talked about before. It's hard to run a tool that gives you an accurate thing. You know, if you're just using regexes, you're a bit limited. They'd want something. So, but they said they sort of half considered it, because for them it'd be quite good to see, you know, how much are people using certain C# features compared to another, and does that influence future language design and stuff like that. So I'm sure they have other stuff they could look themselves. But yeah, that was the sort of semi-serious side of it, is actually, you know, is there any serious stuff you can do from this? Should it ever affect the direction of the language, understanding which features are used and which ones aren't?
So kind of as we move towards wrapping up, one of the latest posts you've done here was like looking at opensource.net after 3 years and seeing community participation and that sort of thing. I thought it was pretty interesting to see, for instance, like F#, 87% community versus 13% Microsoft, and even things like MVC, 76% community. Any that kind of jumped out at you as surprising in this?
Yeah, so it's because I'd started seeing Scott Hanselman and other people doing talks, maybe even yourself, like this headline figure of 60% of the contributions to .NET Core come from the community, and there's a bit behind it. I think they're talking about Core CLR and Core FX in those numbers. I just ran some stuff on the GitHub. Has quite a nice API, so you can and it seems to be either a corporate mandate or something that everyone who's a Microsoft employee has Microsoft as their company on their GitHub page. I don't know if that's for sure, but I certainly noticed it in most of the cases I knew the person worked at Microsoft. So I think there's a fairly accurate way of saying, is this person employed by Microsoft to do this code, or is it someone from the community? That's the sort of split I did. And as you say, like F# is way at the top. There's a few interesting ones, I guess, around the compiler. So there's a lot more community contribution in the compiler for issues than there is for pull requests. And that was reflected in a lot of places, but compiler was the one that had a fair range there. I guess there's nothing wrong with issues, but there's a lot less work involved in opening an issue and even continuing discussion versus sending a pull request. It still seems that compilers is one of the harder areas for the community to contribute. Just, I guess, the nature of it. But I was surprised that the Core CLR had quite a high level of community contributions, although arguably probably quite a few of those came from Samsung. So, yeah, maybe a next year's one, if I have enough time, would be to try and look at it even more and look at community, which is backed by commercial companies, versus community, which is people in their spare time. But that's a bit trickier to look at. But I think it's just interesting. The numbers of community and stuff is interesting to see a split, but I was also quite encouraged by the fact that most of the repositories had a general trend of contributions continuing. Some were continuing up, you know, VS Code and some of those have a real high trajectory. They've kind of gone from nowhere to some of the biggest repositories on GitHub. But even the Roslyn compiler, the CoreCLR, CoreFX, they're very active repositories. They didn't just, I mean, they had a bit of a peak when they first came out. I guess everyone was diving in. It was all new and open source. But even over the years, we're 3 years in now, aren't we, with the open sourcing of those. Anyway, there's been a sustained stuff going on. Obviously, a clear amount of that is Microsoft employees, but there's been a sustained stuff. I think it's quite good for us as people who aren't Microsoft employees, but are part of, if you like, the .NET community, to see that there is something healthy going on here, and it's not... What's the expression? It's not just source open, it's open source. Is that the right thing? It's not just the code's gone out there and they're developing as they were before, but we're just seeing it, every few months as a code drop. This stuff generally is happening out in the open, and there seems to be a decent amount of community contributions across, all the levels of the stack, MVC. The one I found that people didn't want to contribute so much was MS Build, I guess.
Yeah.
Some things, if you're doing it in your spare time and you give it, you have to really want like MS Build to contribute. But even that, because it's, MS Build's changed a bit now. It's part of the tooling in a different way, isn't it, with the .NET Build command line and all that sort of stuff. So it's become a bit more significant. So mm-hmm. I think the main encouraging stuff I think I've definitely seen is that it's just sustained, and it didn't just sort of all happen and then everyone went away.
Yeah, it's nice to look in here kind of at trends over time, and look at community, and there's ebbs and flows. For instance, like Kestrel, I see there are times previously where there was a huge amount of, it was mostly community contributed at peaks, and then there's other times where there's, more Microsoft and kind of, over time as things kind of move back and forth.
Yeah, I call that the Ben Adams contribution.
Yeah.
But it's another interesting thing actually I've noticed with that. So that because a lot of like crazy performance stuff went into that, because it's a newer web server. It doesn't have, I guess, the backs of compatibility. They could almost try stuff out. And I know now it's sort of gone through a period of harding and stuff. It's becoming... It's going to be released, isn't it? Is applicable to be used for real life stuff. It's not just trying stuff out. Mm-hmm. But what I've noticed as well is actually stuff coming from that making its way into other parts of the framework as well. So that was sort of the big, let's throw all the crazy performance optimizations in there, because it does the Tech Empower benchmarks, and it gets, which I think is good. It gets .NET as a, some people will use those Tech Empower benchmarks, and up till now there hasn't been a decent .NET option on there. So it's good that we have that, because all the other runtimes have that. So it's something that .NET was missing. But it's nice that some of those, within reason, I think, are making their way into other parts of the framework, the more general stuff in MVC, or where there's other, they can't just try out all these crazy perf improvements in those places because they've got other issues, compatibility, and there's more stuff going on. But it's nice that performance is sort of spreading out around a lot of places in the runtime as well. You definitely see that. There's a lot of performance improvements have gone into .NET Core, that's for sure.
Cool. All right. So Matt, as we go to wrapping up, is there, you're doing quite a bit of writing, you're digging deep into everything. Is there, what do you do in your spare time? Any interesting hobbies or fun things?
Well, the stuff for these posts takes a little bit of my time. So in terms of my spare time, I do coding and stuff. I have young kids, so that's another chunk of my spare time. But it's kind of nice when there's one blog post where they've sort of overlapped. My kid had a BBC Micro bit, and he was get to play with it in the day, and I got to play with it at night. So it's kind of nice when those two things overlap. But yeah, between that and work, that sort of keeps me kind of busy. But like a lot of us, I do a bit of this stuff in my spare time, and I don't mind doing it. Some people sort of, I guess people like different things. I'm more than happy to dig into tunnels of .NET runtimes and figure out what's going on. So,
awesome. All right. Well, on my behalf, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, thanks a bunch. Your posts are always very interesting to read, and they also generate a lot of great discussion. I love seeing the comments, the Hacker News discussion, et cetera, because you go to a deeper level and it brings up these really interesting deeper thoughts and, why does it work like this and could it work like this and that kind of thing. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks a bunch, Matt.
Thanks for having me.